Obviously, we've only got an hour, so we'll just make a start, probably. Nina can
catch
up. So, I'm very pleased to introduce again Dr. Dimakaracharya, who's going to speak to us today. Negative Flashes of 1880 and the Realization of Brahman. Over to you.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe I start with some sort of a little bit bitter bites, I would say. It's becoming increasingly fashionable when it comes to Upanishadic studies to criticize the Indian tradition, particularly Shankara, as the representative of traditional commentators. Once he is made into a scapegoat and punished, all criticism is directed towards the tradition or those who still listen to it. Now we forget to apply the same standard of criticism on us. I am sure we do this mechanically from our subconscious mind. When A is defeated, B is the victor, and most of the time victors have impunity. This does not mean that I want to defend Shankara or any other traditional scholar at all costs. I agree that Shankara has, like any other modern or traditional scholar, has misunderstood certain things. And sometimes has even deliberately twisted the meaning of certain Upanishadic passages in favor of his favorite concept. But this does not mean that he is wrong at every point. My point is that many times we begin to criticize something because it is coming from the tradition. However, the situation is that these scholars of remote past are still capable of shedding considerable amount of light in the path of traditional knowledge, despite of all limitations of human mind and their limited access to the resources needed to be in the appreciable path of a modern scholar. Anyway, I find that there is a real need for critical studies of early Upanishads. There are some serious flaws in traditional as well as modern interpretations of them. To substantiate my claim, today I present the discourse of Ajatasatru and Gargya, which introduces the important formula of neti neti. I will expose some of text critical as well as interpretational problems and try to fix them as much as possible. The Murta Murta Brahmana from the Madhukanda of Brihadaranyaka Upanishad introduces the neti neti formula and makes a remark on it. I have the passage there on the top. But in the Yajnavalkya Kanda, this formula, neti neti, is blended in a particular statement describing Atman that is repeated at least three times. From Sanskrit commentaries, one can gather that this formula is traditionally interpreted in two ways. The first interpretation has not attracted proper attention of scholars and is not yet well analyzed, but the second one, that is adopted by Shankara, has become the favorite of most of the modern translations. On the other hand, a scholar of high repute like Karl F. Geltner has interpreted this formula as a double negation. Na iti na iti. Geltner's ingenious interpretation has now been revived in a bit altered form by Walter Schley in his New German Translation of Major Upanishads, 2009. Like Geltner, Schley relies on the so-called contemporary Upanishadic explanation of neti neti formula, that is this nahiye tasmad iti neti anyat paramasti. They both agree that such an explanation is found in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad itself, and that explanation asks for a positive meaning of the formula. In the light of this revelation, they reject the two standard interpretations of neti neti available to them and present their version of double negative interpretation of the formula. According to Schley and Geltner, the remark this nahiye tasmad iti na iti anyat paramasti, which follows immediately after the neti neti formula, is a gloss on the formula itself. At the first glance, this identification appears convincing. In fact, the traditional commentators before Shankara had a similar view, which Shankara has narrated in his Bhashya. However, this view does not proclaim double negative meaning of the formula as Geltner and Schley has done. This idea cannot be accepted, though it looks ingenious and attractive. For the validity of this idea, it is necessary that this so-called gloss is exclusively associated with neti neti, but I have traced it in the Satpatha Brahmana itself in the ninth Kanda. I have the passage here. There, this remark is made to justify that the sacred fire is equated with the distance of 1,000 yojanas, sahasra yojana, the farthest distance. Let me first quote the relevant passage, maybe a bit from above. Tadvai sahasra yojana iti. It comes from Yajurveda. So, etadha paramam duram yat sahasra yojanam. Tad yadeva paramam duram tad eva esam etad dhanumsi avatanoti. And then this passage, yad uyevaha sahasra yojana iti, ayam agnihi sahasra yojanam, nahiye tasmad iti neti anyat paramasti, tad yad agnau juhoti, tad evaisam sahasra yojane dhanumsi avatanoti. First of all, this passage provides evidence for the fact that nahiye tasmad, etc., is merely a rhetorical remark devised to claim supremacy of some specific entity being described. It is not specific to the interpretation of neti neti formula. In addition, at this place, the verb asti is clearly accented, and this clears all doubts about the structure of this sentence. In Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it is not clear because of the marking system. But from this passage, we can be sure about the accent. This clarifies the meaning, main logic of the sentence. There is no other superior entity beyond the one just proposed. We can be clear about the itineti phrase in the middle of this remark by analyzing the sole occurrence of this phrase in the Atharva Veda. I skip that analysis, but my conclusion is that this elliptical phrase can be translated as either so or not so, meaning either defined positively as X or defined negatively as not X. So, iti na iti. Now let me translate this whole the new passage of this related with sacred fire. There indeed the formula, Yajurvedic formula, says at the distance of 1,000 yojanas. What the distance of 1,000 yojanas signifies is exactly the farthest distance there. Therefore, where the farthest distance lies, exactly there, in this way, having gratified the Rudras with much food, the sacrificer unstrings the bows of these Rudras. Then analysis comes. Why, I ask, the formula precisely says at the distance of 1,000 yojanas. This sacred fire here is the distance of 1,000 yojanas. For beyond this sacred fire, there is no other entity. Either it is defined positively as X or negatively as non-X. Therefore, as soon as the sacrificer oblates in the sacred fire, he unstrings the bows of these Rudras at the distance of 1,000 yojanas. Now I go back to the same remark in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where it declares supremacy of Purusha. For the time being, I avoid to translate the formula itself, neti neti. Athata adesha neti neti nahiye tasmad iti na iti anyat paramasti. Now, hereafter is the indication, the indicated teaching, neti neti. For beyond this Purusha, there is no other entity either defined positively as X or negatively as not X. Now, let me briefly explain about the implications of this remark. In the first passage, the remark implies that people can try to define the reality of the ritual world in various positive as well as negative ways, but their descriptions do not go beyond the sacred fire, because no entity superior than that exists. So, in the ritual context, the expression sahasra yojana, that signifies the farthest distance, must refer to the sacred fire. Likewise, in the second passage, the remark implies that people can use both positive as well as negative indicative statements in their philosophical pursuits, but they cannot go beyond Purusha. So, the consecutive negation of neti neti, which goes on until the totality of Purusha is understood, refers always to Purusha. Thus, with this new evidence at hand, we can conclude that the sentence immediately following the neti neti formula in the Madhukanda of Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is not a gloss to the formula, but just a general rhetorical remark. This means that all those modern and traditional interpretations of neti neti which rely on this remark are mistaken, at least on methodological grounds, and now this should be tested on contextual grounds. In order to decide the neti neti formula in its original context, it is necessary to read Brihadaranyaka 2.1 and 2.3 together. These two sections make a continuous discourse, whereas section 2.2 is a digression dividing the original discourse as if a puzzle presented in the lunch break and should be read separately. So I present section 2.1 and 2.3 in my translation together with some comments. Dripta Balaki was a learned Gargya. He said to Ajatasatru, the king of Kashi, let me tell you about Brahman. Ajatasatru replied, we will give 1,000 cows for such a speech. Janaka, Janaka here, crying this way, people will rush to me. Then Gargya said, whoever in this is this Purusha here in the sun, just him I venerate as Brahman. Ajatasatru replied, don't start telling me about him. I venerate him rather as the outstanding of all beings, the top, the king. A man who venerates him this way would become the outstanding of all beings, the top, the king. Then Gargya said, whoever is this Purusha here in the moon, him precisely I venerate as Brahman. Ajatasatru replied, don't start telling me about him. I venerate him rather as the lofty one clad in silver robe, Soma, the king. The one who venerates him this way will definitely have enough soma pressed for him every day. His food would never decrease. Then Gargya said, whoever is this Purusha here in lightning, him precisely I venerate as Brahman. That way, so he goes on, I have given you the table, different locuses are there, and then the names, Ajatasatru names the Purusha there. From Vidyut lightning, he shifts to Akasha, then to Vayu, then to Agni, then to Apu, then to Adarsha, mirror, and then to the quarters, then Shabda, then shadow, and then the living body, Atman. And here, please note that Atman is a locus. It is not the soul, but the locus of Purusha, the soul. So, okay, I skip the translation for the sake of time being. This discourse, this whole discourse, where Gargya proposes and then Ajatasatru denies and somehow distracts him, is indeed a dramatical but revealing presentation of a teaching session. And its exact purpose lies in demonstrating identity of Brahman and Purusha in a proper way, so that the seeker of the truth does not stop at one particular approximation before understanding it wholly. As one can apprehend from the above passages, Gargya and Ajatasatru both agree on identification of Brahman with Purusha. There is no problem. And this serves as the common ground for their discourse. Gargya always points at some entity and proposes to identify the Purusha there as Brahman. Ajatasatru wants to find out in which level of understanding Gargya is standing when he is proposing a certain identity and shows limitations of that particular Purusha there. This makes Gargya shift to some other Purusha at some other location. In fact, it is not the case that many individual Purushas exist in different locations, but particular aspects of the one and the same Purusha. However, each time the king tries to distract Gargya and sticks to the outward appearance of Purusha, or rather the personification of a certain aspect of the Purusha there, Gargya moves a step backward instead of pushing the king aside and making his stance clear. This proves that his perspective is faulty and incomplete. A man prone to be misled cannot lead others to the goal. Thus the table is turned, and the Brahmin Gargya himself is in a position lower than the Kshatriya king Ajatasatru. Now I go back to the translation. Then Gargya said at the end, let me approach you as a student. Ajatasatru replied, it is rather the reverse, that a Brahmin would approach a Kshatriya thinking he will tell me Brahman. Immediately, I am going to let you know. Holding him by hand, the king stood up. One interesting point is there. Whenever there is this Brahmin is approaching the Kshatriya, he says, I will immediately tell you, or he does not want to have Upanayana. So it is not formal studentship. So I have checked systematically. And then in one passage, actually even the king's Ashwapati says, without initiation, without Upanayana. They too reached a sleeping man. The king invoked him by these names. O lofty one, you clad in the silver robe. O Soma, the king. He did not stand up. The king waked him by squeezing his hand, and he stood up, the sleeping man. Let me comment again. The words Ajatasatru used to address the sleeping man reflect some textual discrepancy. I have that in the first table there. We can be sure from the context that by addressing the sleeping man this way, Ajatasatru aims to demonstrate that Garga's proposed solutions are ineffective, that means under-pervasive. Garga's first proposition was that the Purusha in the sun is Brahman, but Ajatasatru had identified that as Atishtha Sarvesham Bhutana Murdha Raja. In the next step, Garga had turned to the Purusha in the moon, but Ajatasatru had identified that as Brihan Pandaravasa Somo Raja. Now, in the paragraph just I read, Ajatasatru is addressing the sleeping man with Brihan Pandaravasa Basa in vocative Soma Rajan, as if he is starting with the second item in the list. One can say that he has randomly picked it up from the list of Garga, but this would be quite illogical. As the second option, we can assume that he had picked up two items, the first two items from the list, but the phrase for the Purusha in the sun, for example, Bhutana Murdhan Rajan, has been dropped off from this passage. This is logical and just possible, but is not the right solution, I would say. As soon as we read parallel passages from the Kaushitaki Upanishad, we can see more problems and solutions as well. Table is more useful. The whole of Brihadaranyaka 2.1 with some alteration can be found in the Kaushitaki Upanishad as its fourth chapter. Although down in the passage Kaushitaki Upanishad where the sleeping man is addressed, the text matches with Brihadaranyaka, but the text is different in its opening paragraphs. Here, Ajatasatru counters Garga's argument by identifying the Purusha in the sun as Brihan Pandaravasa Atishtha Sarvesham Bhutanam Murdha Raja. So, the difference is that in Brihadaranyaka, Brihan Pandaravasa is in the part of Chandra, but now in Kaushitaki, this Brihan Pandaravasa is in the part of Surya. So, this actually helps now to understand the passage. This passage of Kaushitaki Upanishad has rightly placed Brihan on the side of sun, but has still wrongly included Pandaravasaha in the sun's description, which would have been better left for the moon. I say this because we get the information from Brihadaranyaka section 3, paragraph 10, that the sun has association with a golden safflower robe, Maharajanam Basaha, should rather be called, hypothetically, Maharajanabasaha, not Pandaravasaha. This makes me suspect that there existed a more concise and compact Ur text of this discourse, which served the base for both versions of Brihadaranyaka as well as Kaushitaki. I would say at the time of revision or expansion, they were not sure which name and description belong to the sun and which to the moon. Maharajanabasaha was dropped from Brihadaranyaka 2.1.3 as the myth of the sun's golden robe was no more familiar, although Maharajanabasaha remained intact in the cryptic passage of Brihadaranyaka 2.3.10, its connection with the Brihadaranyaka 2.1.3 was no more understood and the real purport got lost. Now, let me go back into the discourse of Ajatasatru. Ajatasatru asked, when he was asleep here, this person consisting of consciousness, where was this then lying? Where has it now come from? Garga could not think of that at all. Ajatasatru said, when he was asleep here, that Purusha, which consists of consciousness, having driven his consciousness along with the consciousness of these vital functions, was lying in the space this is here inside the heart. When he seizes them, then is this what is called a man is sleeping. Then the vital function is seized, the speech is seized, the function of sight is seized, the function, faculty of hearing is seized, the mind is seized. Here, wherever he goes with his dream vision, those are his walls. Then he can be either like a great king or a great Brahmin and settle down in a high or low state. He is free. Just like a great king would take his countrymen along and move all over his country at his will. In the same way, this Purusha, taking the vital functions along, moves here all over his body at his will. But when he is fast asleep, when he doesn't know of anything, 72,000 of veins, I am pretty sure that this 72 is not does not belong to the original, but it would be big digression, so I don't discuss that now. It comes from the margin, and it's related with the counting of the these sections of Shatapatha Brahmana. Thousands of veins called Hita run from the heart towards the heart of the heart. Along with these, having crept deep, he lies down in the heart of the heart, like a young man or a great Brahmin would lie down after reaching the extreme intensity of bliss. In the same way, this Purusha lies down here. Then the last paragraph comes. Please listen carefully. I will be commenting on this last paragraph. Like a spider casts out the threads, like the tiny sparks rise up from a fire, in the same way, from this Atman, all vital functions, all worlds, all gods, all beings, all these rise up. The sacred terms for this is the reality of reality. The reality is, the reality are the vital functions, and their reality is this Atman. We have reached the end of the first section, and let me have some remarks. It might make some scholars frown their eyebrows, but I am compelled to say that the last paragraph just I read does not belong to the original layer of Gargaya and Ajatasatru discourse. Till paragraph 22, the discourse is focused on Purusha, not Atman, and the same is true with the rest of the discourse in section 3. In the entire discourse, Atman is not yet treated as equivalent or synonymous to Purusha. Rather, when it appears in paragraph 13 of the first section, Atman just means living body, one of the loki of Purusha. Therefore, paragraph 23, the last paragraph, which all of a sudden replaces Purusha with Atman and makes it the source of all the worlds, gods and beings, which were not mentioned at all before, cannot be part of the original discourse. Once we mark this discrepancy, we can see another odd aspect of this paragraph. Its concluding lines, satyasya satyamiti, pranabai satyam, tesam esa satyam, these lines are identical with the concluding lines of section 3. This conclusion is not fitting here at all. It is obviously illogical to talk about satyasya satya, when we have not yet talked about Satya, we have not analyzed, which is due in section 3. Actually, in paragraphs 16 to 22 above, Ajatasatru described only the case of conscious Purusha in the living body, in bodily realm. But he has not yet described how that Purusha stands as Brahman, which was the main issue, the starting point. Therefore, the discourse of Gargaya and Ajatasatru is still incomplete, and they still have to talk about Brahman. So, without section 3, the discourse is incomplete. In section 3, Purusha is back again and is identified as the essence of Brahman when there is no trace of Atman. Anyway, my conclusion altogether is that by the time of the final canonization of the available text of Brihadaranyaka, one indivisible text of the original discourse of Gargaya and Ajatasatru was split into two. A new paragraph was composed claiming Atman, the cause of every entity, and then the concluding lines of the original discourse from section 3 were appended to it, and this new paragraph was placed at the end of the first part, divided part. A new puzzle was placed in between these two segments to make them permanently separated and so independent. I don't know why. At this point, I would like to mention that while Gargaya and Ajatasatru are talking all the time about Purusha, Yajnavalkya is talking all the time about Atman. It is well known that Atman originally means the living body, not the soul or the essence inside an entity which is reserved originally for Purusha. These meanings of Atman and Purusha are valid in the discourse of original meanings, discourse of Gargaya and Ajatasatru. But by the time of the discourses of Yajnavalkya, the situation has changed. Now Atman is referring to the soul and the essence at the core of an entity, whereas Purusha has been degraded to mean, most of the time, a human being or a male animal. And that's why generally avoided in philosophical context. Yajnavalkya has dropped the term Purusha and has picked up the term Atman that is more accurate in the standards of his time. Here, I don't want to go into the detail of morphological and semantic development of Purusha and the impact of this my finding. Actually, it would have big impact. Like now we can distinguish between the pre-Buddhistic or earlier layer of Brihadaranyaka, where Purusha means the soul, and then the a bit younger layer where Atman means the soul. And it is quite important because in early Buddhism even, they talk about anatta, anatma, but not about apurusha. Because so that means already in early Buddhist phase, purusha was not the issue. Atman was the issue. And this new meaning of Atman was valid. So, I must say at this juncture that with this revelation and others following, we are compelled to change our opinion about the formulation of Brihadaranyaka. It is no more possible to take the Gargaya Ajatasatru discourse as the brackets to the Maitreyi episode, as some scholars have argued in the past. Instead, we have to say that the Gargaya Ajatasatru discourse belongs to the older layer and Yajnavalkya's discourses to the younger layer. I will discuss this in detail again, maybe a different occasion. Anyway, my point of arguments becomes clearer when we read further. So I propose to read further. So the section 3. Two indeed are the forms of Brahman, the corporeal and non-corporeal, the mortal and immortal, the stationary and mobile, the sat and tyam. You see, now satya is divided into sat and tyam. So this is real analysis of satya. It is the corporeal, which is different from air and the intermediate space. It is the mortal, it is stationary, and it is sat. Of the corporeal, of the mortal, of the stationary, of sat, the essence is this here, which is burning, so pointing at the sun. It is definitely the essence of sat. The non-corporeal now is the air as well as the intermediate space. It is immortal, it is mobile, it is tyam. Of the non-corporeal, of the immortal, of the mobile, of tyam, the essence is the purusha here inside the sun's ball. It is definitely the essence of tyam, thus is with regard to the divine realm. Now, with regard to the bodily realm, all this is the corporeal, which is different from the vital air and the space inside the body. It is mortal, it is stationary, it is sat. Of the corporeal, of the mortal, of the stationary, of sat, the essence is this here, the I. It is definitely the essence of sat. Now, the vital air and space inside the body is the non-corporeal. It is immortal, it is mobile, it is tyam. Of the non-corporeal, of the immortal, of the mobile, of tyam, the essence is this here, the purusha, shining through in the right eye. It is definitely the essence of tyam. Then comes a paragraph which has been misunderstood since unknown times. The form of this purusha is as the safflower robe. as the white fleece, as the protective power of Indra. This is my translation, it is completely new. As the flame of fire, as the beauty lotus, as the once for all irradiation. One who knows the Purusha this way, his excellence will be precisely like the once for all irradiation. Very funnily, all the scholars, starting from Shankara, they relate these items with color, red, white, yellow. That doesn't work. Okay. Let me read the last paragraph also, and then I have my comments. Then comes this Neti Neti passage. Here, after all this, is the indication. Now I would translate Neti Neti as no, no. Beyond this, for beyond this Purusha, there is no other entity. Either it is defined positively as X or negatively as not X. So now, what this no, no means, and to analyze the paragraph before I proceed. A proper understanding of the second last paragraph I just read is very crucial for the understanding of the whole discourse. But I am sorry to say that this paragraph is misunderstood by all the traditional commentators as well as modern scholars. I claim that the text is speaking exactly about the Purusha foreshining at every locus, which is characterized by Ajatasatru in his conclusion as Vijnanamaya, the essence of the non-corporeal form of Brahman. It cannot be anything else. Like Shankara relates it with Vasana and other thing, and for this safflower robe, this golden color, he fancies that when we have affectionate relation with ladies, our mind is formed that way, in that color. If we closely look at this paragraph, it proves to be very simple and unambiguous. First of all, as the moon has been described as Pandara Vasa in the first section, we can easily associate Pandva Vikam, the silver fleece, with the moon. Now, the safflower robe, which is placed before the silver fleece as the first item in the list, should logically be related with the sun, the first locus Garga had pointed to locate the Purusha and equate with Brahman. Thus, when Ajatasatru says here in this second last paragraph that the appearance of this Purusha is as the safflower robe and as the silver fleece, he is referring to the specific form or appearance of Purusha in the sun and the moon respectively. It is very logical to dress the moon in white, and he is visualized that way, when he is personified as a king. Similarly, the sun is always visualized in golden color, and the safflower robe is an appropriate outfit for him. They represent the dual kingship of Kshatra and Brahman, and the safflower robe and silver fleece are their symbols. In other words, these are the specific symbolic aspects which transform the Purusha into the two kings. When Ajatasatru further says that the appearance of the Purusha is as the protective power of Indra, this is my translation, and until now they have interpreted it as the red insect, red bug, either this bug or that bug. Again, starting from Shankaracharya, ending to with Sly. As the flame of fire, as the beauty lotus, so altogether, he is referring to the distinct forms of the Purusha in the wind, fire, and water respectively, that I have put in the chart also. The last item, as the once for all irradiation, is stated, skipping three items in the middle, and it refers to the last item in Garga's list, the Purusha in the living body, Atman. This once-for-all irradiation involves sudden, immediate, and explosive diffusion of the Purusha as the true form, shining forth and reaching every end of every entity in the world of distinct forms, but in one's own body, it is the conscious self and reaches every tip of each limb. Thus, it is clear that Ajatasatru is talking about the Purusha and its apparent forms in its different manifestations. Ajatasatru had previously identified the Purusha at each and every locus Gargya pointed out, beginning with the sun and ending with the living body of an individual, as a distinct Purusha that I have in the chart, Brihat, Soma, Tejasvi, and so on. As I indicated earlier, this was his trick to check and correct the incomplete view of Gargya. Now, since it is his chance and duty to make Gargya know the reality, he explains to Gargya that it is the same Vijnanamaya Purusha everywhere and it is its appearance that differs according to the locus. These appearances are so specific that they appear to an unattentive man like Gargya as different Purushas or different deities. In each and every case, what is taken as the locus is the coarse corporeal form of Brahman, and the name associated there tells us about the appearance of Purusha there. Naming serves as the device that gives individualized identity to a specific appearance of Purusha in a particular state, and thus a name just reflects the function of Purusha in a specific locus. Now, Ajatasatru is clarifying about the various subtle appearances of Purusha, who is stuck to the coarse form and one particular appearance or individualized identity. He cannot realize the reality, the wholeness of Purusha. His outlook is always incomplete. When a seeker of truth begins his quest with an observation of the expansive world outside and wishes to understand it, he first faces the coarse and multifold form of reality in the form of distinct individual identities, entities. He begins with creating a hierarchy of these entities and seeking for the primordial source or the essential entity. In this high tide of the quest, he first approaches the farthest and the highest, the Purusha, irradiating in the solar disk and serving as the powerhouse of the cosmos. But when his mind settles, he finally reaches the closest and deepest, the Purusha, irradiating in his own living body. This makes him give up the notion of hierarchy based on compartmentalization. This is the state of neti-neti, which leads him to the core of all entities and confront the same Purusha irradiating everywhere, the subtlest and natural form beyond all distinctions. After Ajatasatru conveyed his idea this way in a dramatic demonstration, he imparts the Adesha, the teaching indicated through the whole discourse. Again, I don't go into detail, but all the time I am taking Adesha literally as indication and as it is accented, we can say that we have to take either agentive interpretation or as object. So it is the object of indication or the which is indicated or which is the indicator. But since quite long time, Thimabe, who was the person who proposed that it is substitute, and probably that was the part of big confusion. That doesn't work now. This is the method which one should apply to understand the neti-neti, understand Brahman, and reach the deep-seated Purusha, the reality of reality. With the neti-neti formula, Ajatasatru is telling us this way, say no to all attributions as I did, until the reality of totality is revealed. Now, I think we should translate neti-neti as no-no, as I did, and say that these two negations abbreviate, as Shankara interprets, the entire series of negative answers which denied one after the other all propositions put forward in the discourse by Gargya. No to the proposition that says Purusha in the sun is Brahman, no to that which proposes Purusha in the moon as the Brahman, no to that which proposes Purusha in the lightning as Brahman, and finally no even to that which proposes Purusha in the living body as Brahman. This implies that Brahman cannot be defined as a mundane entity by drawing a boundary of specification. As soon as one realizes this fact, all the boundaries of specification collapse at once, and at that very moment, the series of negations is terminated. Now, man realizes that one and the same Purusha is everywhere, though it appears differently at different places. If he limits it to one particular place, whatever high, whatever deep, he is mistaken like Gargya. This is the gist the indicated teaching of this whole discourse, and this wisdom is applicable to all epistemological investigations. Now we must note that as soon as Ajatasatru negated all of the approximations offered by Gargya, he immediately synthesized them as various appearances or forms, personifications of one and the same Purusha. He analyzed Brahman, described the way Purusha appears in various places, and imparted the method involved there. Only after all this, he proposed an appellation for Purusha, the reality of reality, a positive description. This implies that both negative and positive ways of presentation are necessary to explain the reality. They complement each other. Therefore, another important message of this discourse is that any definition or description has limitations when it comes to the ultimate reality, and a seeker of the truth has to find a way to reach its totality. Generally, an affirmative statement assigns one particular property to the entity being described and excludes other properties, and there is always the danger that a property is mistaken for the property possessor. To avoid these problems, the method of consecutive negation is needed. Once a person is awakened to the totality of reality from this enlightened realm, he can make all kinds of statements, either affirmative or negative. But only those people understand him rightly, particularly his affirmative statements, who are trained in this method and are themselves awakened to the totality of the reality. And Ajatasatru was this way training Gargya. So in the whole discourse. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Divakar.
Yeah.
So 1990. Do we have questions or responses?
I'm sorry, just the I'm trying to grasp the implication of your paper. So what would you say, just given the fact that this sentence is so kind of central to later sort of Vedantic thought, sort of if you bring in your new interpretation, so to say, of this section, what would be the kind of foreseeable implications?
No, I mean, you mean about neti-neti?
Yeah, about neti-neti. Like for example, you said that both positive and negative definitions are necessary. I think that's a very significant one sort of implication.
No, I think that is well established in the tradition.
Mm.
The only problem is that now some philologists or some modern scholars are making noise. That's why I started with that. The tradition, yeah, just somehow they say that almost it seems that whatever comes from the tradition is not so interesting, and they want to interpret as double negative, so everything is as it is, this way. Yeah, philosophically I would agree with that, but if it's coming from an enlightened person who is awakened in this state of totality, but otherwise it's nonsense. And to interpret this discourse, which actually clarifies all these problems that way, will be a mistake. And actually, because the textual problems involved there were not identified, were not addressed, so that's why there is a lot of confusion. So in case of the interpretation of neti-neti, actually I am somehow restoring back the traditional interpretation of neti-neti. But what is new is I am identifying the text critical problems. And another thing is, like Vedist, they think that the Vedic text is like written on stone. You cannot alter at all, you cannot amend, so it is fixed. I already have shown you that there is quite a lot of text critical problem.
Whereabouts do the different textual interpolations come from? So you're saying there were different layers within the...
No, but different layer is... that's why I suspect that there was some a bit brief, concise, some text, some Ur text. And it's even possible that they are on that side. I have not contemplated enough, but it's even possible that there was some Upanishad, some sort of common reservoir from where all Upanishads of all traditions they have borrowed. But that may be at the present state of my research, that would be too far. But this much I can say that but there was a bit concise text, and then these things were probably, it's even possible that it was versified or some sort of formulaic, and then when they started to present it in a bit elaborated form, in the form of discourse, they were no more able to understand certain themes there, like this idea of the safflower robe, and because of certain ideas they had already in mind, they misinterpreted certain thing, and then that way, the confusion started, and they probably dropped a certain thing.
Because were there sort of schools of reciters who used to recite these texts originally before they were written down?
Another thing is, Vedic texts are recited, but now we must think more about how much. You know? Like, I am trained in Vedic tradition, so I can say that it was my duty to learn my Veda. So even maybe now I don't remember, but by heart. It comes to the Brahmana and then Upanishad. So there is hierarchy: Veda, Brahmana, Upanishad, and then Sutras. And on the day of Upakarma, that is actually the inauguration of the semester. No? So we are supposed to read at least that, and that probably happened in the school. But now everything is ritualized and then abbreviated. What we do on the day of Upakarma is we abbreviate and we just read the pratikas from top to bottom of everything. Probably it was not this much like the Vedic Samhita itself. I doubt that Brahmanas and Upanishads were that way regularly recited. So that is one thing. And now I'm saying that what I'm saying probably happened before it was canonized, you know, and presented in this form. And if we they say that by the time of Ashoka there was already a writing system, so maybe they started to write and then certain thing from margin even crept in.
There have been differences because the very interesting text is the Kaushitaki, which has already proved that there are things that are taken away from one group of text to put into another text. That has been worked. Patrick Oliphant has written something about the layering and the text building, I think. He was talking here last year and so about it. And it is true that when one's text is frozen and used as a magical incident, then you cannot make any difference. You have to put it absolutely syllable by syllable. But that freezing point was a bit later. There was an earlier period when it didn't freeze into that sort of thing.
I suppose I was just thinking that, you know, if it's written down, it's probably easier if you're transcribing things to change things. But if you're reciting something, you have a sort of school of reciters, then it might be more difficult.
Yeah, everything is recited. Think that New Testament was also recited because it's not immediately somebody to have typed down what the Christ said. And everywhere, Muhammad also asked somebody and he dictated. So there is a sort of thing. But it is also, you said that there are sort of groups of people who kept these things. So, and there are two section of people. Interestingly said both were kings, the Brahmins and the and the Kshatriyas. That's the two king theory, mm-hmm. you said. That means they were both equally powerful, is it?
Probably.
That was it.
Yeah.
That you said.
Dwell.
The dwell. That was an interesting point.
But in early phase, probably it was this sort of Brahma Kshatra was one cluster, and it was not that much segregated.
Do you mean that there's a sort of the simile with the sun and the simile with the moon that mm-hmm. indicated that there's the kshatra power, which is energy, and
mm-hmm.
The Brahmin power, that's the cooling soma.
Can be, but I have not thought on that side, that
that's
implication.
Interesting.
But about this reciting, like if you check different versions of Veda, even already even in Samhita, you have variations. So some extra words like Esosmakam Brahmananam Raja, Somosmakam Brahmananam Guraja. In one version, we have that. In another, Esosmakam Raja. And then in some other, Esosmakam Brahmananam. And then some extra adjective is there. So variations are there. Even in, because I myself recite, and many times what happens, within mind, there can be some loop, and because of similar word, I can jump from one loop to another loop. I give you example, Nanya Pantha Vidyate Yanaya is the end of one mantra in Shukla Yajurveda. That is my tradition. And there is no another Nanya Pantha Vidyate Yanaya in Shukla Yajurveda. But if you go in Taittiriya, there is considerable amount of text is skipped between two, Nanya Pantha Vidyate Yanaya. So in Vajrasanaya tradition, in Shukla Yajurveda tradition, once it happened, so it's like the teacher who recites and gives a lesson to the students is like a book. So once it's missing in his mind, it's missing in all students' mind.
So could you have sort of different groups reciting basically the same sort of thing, but making slight variations?
Exactly. So that way the sakhas develop.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's interesting.
So it's like a person who has memorized his alive book. And sometimes, like the reciters, probably that they don't do consciously in case of Vedic text, but in case of classical text, and in Vedic context, I have no capacity even, but in case of classical text, when something is missing, if I have this side and that side, I try to force my mind to reconstruct, and most of the time, I am successful in restoring in my mind the exact thing, but sometimes probably my mind enters in the text.
Sorry, just one kind of small question and one sort of bigger question. But so you're explaining about this correspondence between that was your sort of part, kind of main reason to suggest your new interpretation. But I was wondering, so how do you sort of explain this?
No, this is a abbreviation. Once the whole discourse is there, so I can just this way. I start with the beginning two, and then for the sake of abbreviation, I can skip and then come to something, and then the final thing. No?
Okay.
So that's common. Like that we do in our discourse also. No?
Sure.
So that is understood from the context.
Okay. Okay, so you don't expect any sort of...
No, that is, I think, probably not missing that way.
Not missing, okay.
Yeah. But possible, but it is not necessary that once this, as I said, in dramatical way, the whole thing is presented, there is, it's not necessary to repeat everything.
Sure.
Yeah.
Another question was that, so just in the field of this, let's say, Upanishadic study, I'm curious, like, how much of this sort of kind of higher criticism. So
yeah, almost none. And many people are against it. That's why I'm giving a wake-up call.
Sure.
I would say.
Okay, so you would say like this sort of approach is new in this
Upanishadic
study.
And what I presented is just a tip of iceberg. And there are in every step, like there I am interpreting the Puri Tattva as the heart of the heart. Everybody is interpreting as the pericarp, which is outside the heart. And the whole idea is, and they interpret that Atma slips out from the heart, and then in this between space of pericarp and heart, the space in between lies down there. That doesn't work, because we are talking and going from outside to the center, and from the whole context, we should be in the center, not slipping from the center. So from minute, minor things to major things, there are too many problems. Critically, they criticize the tradition, but they have not really freed themselves from the traditional interpretation of the tradition as well as traditional interpretation of the modern scholars. So Shankaracharyas and new Shankaracharyas, I would say.
That's quite.
Is it possible to date this material at all? Brihadaranyaka. What sort of date?
There are different ideas, and not so easy. According to Birjal, because there are two recensions, Madhyandina and Kanwa. His idea is that Kanwa probably was finally canonized when the Kanwa, the kings were there. I'm not sure.
And roughly when was that?
No, but anyway, until now, majority of the people, except a few people, it is pre-Buddhistic. So until now, majority of Indologists, they say that Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya is pre-Buddhist.
What do you feel about some of the theories about putting the Vedas as being much more ancient than hereto?
That I don't subscribe.
Because there's some mentions of the Sarasvati River in the Vedas. That was apparently dried up 3000 BCE, was it, or something?
Yeah.
So some people argue, therefore, the Vedas must have been written before then.
Maybe there are several problems. It's not so easy, and not easy to subscribe. And the linguistic analysis and then linguistic evidence clearly suggest that there was a common Indo-European realm, and then so this sort of, and to believe in, the, I think all that is needed to propose this out of India theory, and that doesn't work linguistically.
No, more inside India, from India, I would say.
Yeah, out of India theory, you know, that is their idea.
Oh, I see.
India theory, that doesn't work. If in future, some more material comes to light, that's another issue. It can be slightly different than the previous historians presented, but not that way drastically different. My feeling is that maybe it's much more like Indian culture or Indian phenomena have much more affinity to earlier Iranian, Indo-Iranian culture, and probably it's possible that the area was much more wider towards that area. Altogether, yeah.
Right, we'll have to see. You were saying about the veins, were they nadis?
Yeah, nadis, exactly. Nadis, and before Brihadaranyaka, and even in other places in Brihadaranyaka, just you have Satam or Sahasram. So, and that is normal to say hundreds and thousands. But why this odd number 72,000? That doesn't work. And actually, just two paragraphs before this passage, there is the marking of Satapatha Brahmana is numbered in Satams. No? So, 100 Granthas are marked. And then very near this passage, there is a marking of 7200. And then this enumeration somehow crept in. And here in this passage, Brihadaranyaka, we don't have even a compound, and it is Dvabhim Satihi Sahasrani. So I think that it is it crept in that way. So if once we get rid of this Dva Saptatihi, then the description is, before and inside, outside as well as inside Brihadaranyaka, it matches. So Sahasrani, thousands, enough. Yeah.
Well, we have to find up there. Thank you so much, Divakar, for sharing with us your scholarship over the last few weeks as well.
Yeah.
And this is your, sadly, this is your last session with us.
Yeah.
So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Yeah, anyway, I'm going to write a whole monograph on these
issues.
Well,
I look forward to reading that, yes.
Is it getting like a... So before monograph, is it getting published like a...
That I'm not yet sure what way I should proceed, but yeah, but this on this discourse article is almost ready, so more than 50 pages, and then on Adesha also, I'm ready. So two sections, maybe more, three sections.
Yeah, no, because like Adesha, it is confusing. Like Oliver, I think also he translates like. The rule of substitution, which is very confusing. For me, as a student, like Oliver's this Upanishad translation is kind of standard.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult. Once it's established as a standard, then it's kind of to goes against. It's for a student, it's very difficult. So it would be very.
That's the scholarship.
Yeah.
You make a hypothesis, you come to, you verify it, you say, oh no, it doesn't verify, so you go another way.
Yeah.
Goes further.
Yeah.
Nothing is fixed.
Yeah, nothing is fixed, that's true.
Even all the Padapata and the Jatapata and all this didn't fix the Vedic text itself, let alone Upanishads and Brahmanas.
Yeah.
It's difficult. And you can also have common sense value. This sort of thing is a common sense value, isn't it?
Yeah.
All this puri sat, tat sat, asat, all these words going on to how you are going to analyze.
Yeah. I mean, it really shows that how relying on translation, doesn't really work.
But it is good that a new vistas are opening, and it's. I've already started with all this new reading side by side. The textual study is very important.
Yeah.
The text, to find it from the text itself.
Yeah.
To have the answer. Real editing and finding.
Sure.
And comparing. That's the best way to find the, well, what human abilities are limited. They can't be clairvoyant, but it is good that way to find. Yes, very good. Well, it's the fundamental of neti neti.
Yeah. Thank you very
Would
much.
You, yes, thanks a lot. Yes.
Yes, in the New Testament you have these parallel texts, don't you? But you don't have anything like that in the Indian material.
What?
In the New Testament studies, you have parallel
exactly.
texts.
Exactly, but in India, we have not, but we have. Now, they are finding out. Now, today, Mr. Acharya already said that there are several things that were different. If you put it together, the Brahmanas and the Upanishads, and different Upanishads, and people don't do it, because that what Shankara commented on became the main Upanishads, and others were neglected, but they are all were in reflecting each other, and you can see it's quite a lot of things that way. Textual study. which is...
You might get a lot of flack for publishing this, you know, in this from the tradition.
Yeah.
They won't like this when you're doing.
Like?
They won't like. They won't appreciate your if you're a very traditional Brahmin who's reciting the text and so on. They won't like your approach.
Mm-hmm. No,
well, they might. They
but
might
if
not.
they are logical, they have to accept.
So you didn't like Slyer's interpretation, or you liked most of them? I know Slyer very well.
No, but I like the Slyer in person. But how
yes.
can now I accept it? Subscribe to his interpretation?
Yeah, he is very interesting man.
Thank you.